So in my final lecture, before Gong takes over next week, I want to discuss what goes on beyond leading order and perturbation theory. So yesterday, we saw how to use Feynman diagrams to do perturbation theory, either to compute endpoint functions using perturbation theory or to compute matrix elements using perturbation theory. But there's one key ingredient that we left out. So if you recall, when we discussed the LSC reduction formula, we saw that we had to shift and rescale our fields in order to make the assumptions for the LSC reduction formula valid. So in particular, if we wanted to study a scalar field theory, with a phi cubed interaction term, it's generally not okay to use the Lagrangian in this form to do perturbation theory beyond leading order. That's because when we derive the LSC reduction formula, we required that the vacuum expectation value of the field was zero. And also that the form factor was the same in the interacting theory as in the free theory. So these two requirements basically came from requiring that the state with phi acting on the vacuum was a one particle state, at least in the asymptotic past and future. And we saw that we could impose these conditions as long as we shifted, rescaled, and renamed our field. So if we are willing to shift, rescale, and rename, we can make these assumptions valid, and we can use perturbation theory. But we're not just free to add a term to the Klein-Gordon-Lagrangian. In general, if we add a term, we also have to shift and rescale our field. And once we do that, our Lagrangian will no longer look like this. We can write it as z phi times kinetic term, get a factor of zm multiplying the mass term, and get a factor of zg multiplying the interaction term, and we also will get an extra term coming from the shift. So if we shift this term, we'll generate a to phi minus some constant. Phi minus a constant cubed will contain a cubic term, a quadratic term, a linear term, and a constant term, which we don't care about. So this linear term comes from the shift of this term. And so we can separate out, so this is the form of Lagrangian we should use to do perturbation theory. We're allowed to use this form of Lagrangian to do perturbation theory, not this one. Presuming that we put appropriate constraints on our factors of z and y to ensure that these assumptions are satisfied. So that's what we're going to do today, is to try to see what constraints these two assumptions put on these coefficients, z and y. And so it's useful to regroup this, to rewrite this Lagrangian in a slightly different way. So we can write this as a free Klein-Gordon Lagrangian plus some interaction Lagrangian, where L free is just the original Klein-Gordon Lagrangian without any factors of Z. And interaction Lagrangian, it's useful and conventional to break it up into two parts, so we can write it as the part we wanted to add. So we wanted to study a theory with a cubic self-interaction. We are forced to modify our coefficients and add a new term in order to use perturbation theory, at least using the LSE reduction formula. And so it's conventional to break up the interaction part of the Lagrangian into the part term we wanted to add, which is the cubic self-interaction. We'll include the factor of Z here, as well as it's called a counter term Lagrangian. And the counter term Lagrangian, which I'll abbreviate by LCT, is just everything else. So that's the difference between our total Lagrangian and kinetic term we have. So we still have left off a factor of 1 half z phi minus 1 times d phi squared. We've also left off a factor of zm minus 1 m squared y squared. And this new term that we didn't want to add but we're forced to add also should be included as a counter term. And so so we started off with a theory with two physical parameters. So one was a mass, and the other one is a coupling constant that controls the strength of the self-interaction. What we had to do is we had to, in order to use the LSE reduction formula, we now have a theory that has more parameters than that. So what we're going to try to do is to understand what constraints these conditions put on the parameters in our new theory, and how we can consistently do perturbation theory, and try to understand how we can consistently do perturbation theory using Lagrangian in this form. So if we want to do perturbation theory, or this theory, we don't just have a single vertex. We have here three different types of interaction. So we have the interaction we wanted to add. There's a cubic self-interaction. And in position space, the Feynman rule for this vertex will just be, what we wanted, but just with some extra factor of zg. So this Feynman rule is modified by the inclusion of this extra factor of zg. But in addition to modifying this Feynman rule, we also have two new vertices. So first of all, we have a new vertex with only a single field operator. So there's a vertex, which I'll draw like this, with an x at the end. And the vertex rule for this is just iy integral d4x. So this is a vertex, not an external point. You can think of it as a single line ending here, but this is an internal point, not an external point. it's integrated over. So single line ends here. We can think of this vertex as three lines coming in and meeting at a point. This is just one line comes in and end, but it's still a vertex in the same sense here as this one is. And then we also have a new vertex with two lines meet. So both of these terms are quadratic in the field. And so there will also be a vertex, I'll draw like this, and while this the Feynman rule for this vertex as you can guess, it's slightly lengthy because there's two different terms, and furthermore, one of the terms involves derivatives, so it'll be much easier to write in momentum space. We do a Fourier transform, this derivative will just become a momentum. So it'll be actually the Feynman rule for this vertex turns out to be a lengthy expression that we won't actually need yet. It's easier to write in momentum space. So this will be some mess. An integral d4x, and there'll be some momentum dependence. We'll postpone this. We won't actually need the detailed form for what we're going to do. It will depend on z phi minus 1, zm minus 1, some momentum dependence. The key point is we have three vertices instead of just one. And to use the LSE reduction formula to compute matrix element, we have to include all of these terms. It's not consistent beyond leading order just to consider a theory with a single single free particle interaction. And so our strategy is we're going to try to determine what constraints these conditions place on our z's and y's. So we're going to determine these perturbatively, zi's and the y's perturbatively. And we expect that the zi's should all be 1. Plus some correction that depends on g. And y should be 0 plus some correction that's order g. Because if we set g to 0, then we're back to the free Klein-Gordon theory, and we don't need any of these terms. Free Klein-Gordon theory is a perfectly fine theory where these are satisfied automatically. These two conditions are satisfied automatically, so we don't need to change the z or the y once we're back in the free theory. So any corrections should be at least order g, and we'll find when we compute them, then actually the corrections to zi will be order g squared. This will turn out to be order g squared.
For the new renormalized kind of like region?
So what I've done in going from this line to this line is I have taken, to go from here to here, I took phi to phi let's say A5 plus B, where A and B are just numbers. And then I have relabeled the coefficients. So this is Z phi. So if we do this chain, we rescale phi and shift it, we will have a kinetic term like this. The coefficient will not necessarily be just a half. You might have some coefficient out front. And similarly, these are the types of terms we should get if we do this shift. We can also get a constant term, which we're just throwing away because that's uninteresting. It doesn't affect the dynamics.
Like apart from the previous one, we just get a linear term, and that's it.
We get a linear term, and we change all the coefficients. So let's see first what this constraint tells us about our new Lagrangian. So the first constraint we want to examine is a constraint that the vacuum expectation value of our field operator should be zero. And well, we know how to compute this using Feynman diagrams. We know how to compute this perturbatively. And we compute this using perturbation theory. Well, the rules we developed yesterday tell us that we should just draw all diagrams that have one external point. And so we can explicitly draw those. So if we have one external point, there are two diagrams we can draw that have a single vertex. So one is we can just connect it to this one-point vertex where the line ends. And the other thing we can do is use the three-line vertex to get a diagram like this. And both of these diagrams will be order G. This diagram will be proportional to Y, and Y is order G. And this diagram will be proportional to ZG times G. And G is 1 plus some higher order correction. So this will that diagram will contain an order G piece. We could go to higher order. There'd be more diagrams. So at next order, some of the diagrams include this one and this one. And there are more. Order g cubes or higher. But if this is zero, then it should be zero at each order in perturbation theory. So in particular, these two diagrams should add up to zero, as well as the sum of all the diagrams at order g cubed should independently sum up to zero. So let's just focus on what these two diagrams tell us about our coefficients first. So if we use our Feynman rules to write down the contribution of these diagrams, this first diagram, we just have a single vertex. We've got an IY integral d4y from the vertex, and then a Feynman propagator from x to y. That's a delta xy. The second diagram gives us we have one vertex, which is a IG. I can ignore the Z here because we're just working to order G. And ZG is 1 plus order G, so the vertex, the contribution of the vertex at the order we're working is just IG before Y. Then we have a propagator from X to Y, so that's a delta XY propagator from Y to Y. And we also have a factor of a half, because this diagram has a symmetry factor of 2. We can exchange the two ends of this propagator from Y to Y, or reflect it, however you like to think about it. And so these are the only two contributions that appear at order G. And we have higher order contributions as well. Okay, so this expression can be simplified or factorized because, well, delta YY, call it this delta YY is the Feynman propagator of Y minus Y. So this is the Feynman propagator evaluated at 0, which is independent of Y. So we can factor that out. We get IY plus a half IG delta F of 0. That's a common, pull that out, and we have a common factor of integral D4Y delta XY. And so, well, this is not 0. There's no reason for this to be 0. So if we want the order G contribution to the vacuum excitation value to be 0, then this quantity in parentheses should vanish at order G. So that tells us that Y is equal to minus a half G delta F of 0. So, great. Yes?
Sorry. I didn't understand why you're not going to have this set J.
So I'm working here at order G. So I have I put in a ZG. It's 1 plus some corrections. Turn out to be order G squared. So if I set Z equal to 1 and I ignore these terms, I'm only ignoring something that's order GQ. So the difference between ZG and 1 is here. Elizabeth?
I have the same question. So it is like you would be introducing ZG, but because we're doing it perturbatively, then you would just say that. Like, we ignore it.
That's right. At the order we're working, we ignore it. Okay, so we've succeeded in a sense. We've determined what Y has to be in order for this condition to hold at leading order. Let's think a little bit more carefully about a result. So we've got here the Feynman propagator evaluated at 0, which is, so we can write this as the integral d4p 2 pi to the fourth of I over p squared minus m squared I epsilon e to the minus I p dot 0. So this factor is just 1. And this integral goes like, if we go to spherical coordinates, this goes like the integral p cubed dp over p squared. So this diverges for large p. The integral goes like p dp, this integral diverges. So this is telling us, in order to impose this condition, we have to add a counter term, a new term to our Lagrangian, which is divergent. Now, that may concern you, but it shouldn't be too concerning. After all, this is not something that we can directly measure. What we can measure, we can never measure a single coefficient in our Lagrangian. We can only measure cross sections or decay rates or some properties of the endpoint correlation functions. And any of those objects are never going to contain just this object in isolation. It will always have several different Feynman diagrams that will contribute to any process we want to compute.
Could you explain why that integral is divergent?
So I've waved my hands a little bit here. So to really I've done something a little bit you might be questioning. So I've gone to basically hyperspherical coordinates, even though this is a Lorentzian integral. So what I've really done is related it to a Euclidean version of the integral. This is something we'll discuss in QFT2. There's actually a map we can make between Lorentzian integrals and Euclidean integrals. But if you just accept that for the moment, or we'll fill in the details in QFT2, that you can see that this in hyperspherical coordinates, this measure becomes like the magnitude of p cubed dp. Over here for large p, we can ignore this, and this goes like p squared. So this is something that will be that will diverge because p dp, we integrate from magnitude of p up to infinity, that will diverge.
Confuse the invariant measure. So d4p can be written as d3p divided by 2ep.
So the integral of the Lorentz invariant measure, this one can be written in terms of the four-dimensional measure with a delta and a, I'm missing two pi's here, and a Heaviside function. So the measure in the Feynman propagator is different from the measure that shows up in our field operators. We're integrating over all four components. It wouldn't make sense to have this measure in the Feynman propagator because we've got a 1 over p squared minus m squared. And if p naught is equal to ep, then this denominator is 0, and we're at the pole. So we're really integrating over all four components. That was an aside. Okay. So we've got a divergent counter term. And there are any number of ways we can deal with this in practice. So we, the math for QFT course, we saw a number of ways we could regulate divergent sums. There's a number of different ways we can regulate divergent integrals. We'll go into a number of those in QFT2. We can define a prescription for making this integral finite and do our calculations and then remove the regulator at the end of our calculations. That's something we'll go into in detail. But for this case, we don't actually really need to do all that because what this result is telling us is, well, there's another way we can phrase what we just computed here. What we saw, we're going to graphically write this equation. This is just saying that in terms of diagrams, this is just the sum of all diagrams with one external point and no vacuum diagrams. And those diagrams should sum up to zero. And so graphically, write that equation like this. So this is any subdiagram with no external points. And so this is true. And this is basically just what we assumed in deriving the LSE reduction formula. And that tells us, for example, that the sum of these two diagrams is zero. Because what's going on in this part of the diagram basically factorizes from the rest of the diagram. So if we were going to write down the expression for these two diagrams, we could, in the same way as we did here, write it, factor out this factor. This diagram will, again, contain a propagator from here to here, which factors out of the integral. And we can write it as iy plus ig times a propagator from y to y. And so these two diagrams will sum to zero for exactly the same. Because these two diagrams add up to zero. And so if we impose this, there's no reason to compute either of these diagrams. We know that, they're both present, they both sum up to zero. And so, more generally, any diagram of this form would also be equal to zero. This is guaranteed to be equal to zero if this is equal to zero. Because our Feynman, we can write the Feynman. If you wrote down the expression for this diagram, it would factorize into this part of the diagram times the rest of the diagram. So there's no need to compute any diagrams like this. And diagrams of this form are called tadpole diagrams. So our first constraint tells us that there's an entire class of diagrams that we just don't need to compute because they'll cancel off at each order in perturbation theory. Any comments or questions on that?
Yeah, I don't think I follow what you're doing with your graphical notation. Like, so what happened with the single line? Not the looped one, but the first one? Yeah, so how does that get encoded in the diagram that you drew on the right?
So this notation just means if we have any, or really the sum of all diagrams like this. All diagrams of this form. So one diagram I can draw that has no external points is I can just draw this part of this diagram.
Okay.
And that's a diagram of this form. Or that I could fill that in for this part of the diagram.
Oh, okay, good. I thought that was a loop. Sorry.
This is just.
It's just a placeholder.
A placeholder for anything else you can fill in to make a valid diagram.
Any contour example? Give some maybe some diagram with several external points.
A subdiagram. So, for example, so I'm looking for diagrams of this form with one external point. So one way I can fill in the rest of this diagram is by just putting this diagram. That's valid. This is a diagram of that type. A diagram where I instead say use this cubic interaction and add two external points. This is a valid diagram. It's not a diagram of this type, because to make a valid diagram, I added two other external points.
And why do they self-discriminate some diagrams?
Because.
Is that just this expansion?
That's just the expansion of this.
Diagrams are zero, or is it?
They're not individually zero. They're individually, they all diverge, but they sum to zero. Yes.
What's the argument when we have two external points? This doesn't come from the from what we did.
So diagrams of this form. So if we sum all the diagrams of this form. I can write this as basically this part of the diagram. So a diagram of this form is equal to basically this part of the diagram times this part of the diagram. So schematically, I can factorize it. And this part is zero.
It's just, oh.
If I sum over this part. This is a schematic.
Are the definitions of external and internal points switched from here to there?
I'm indicating external points as the ones with dots. Yes, and this point becomes an internal point in this diagram, but this external point, basically, the role of this one is just this, it factorized out. So that it didn't matter that that was internal versus external.
This is like back to this sort of stuff.
Yes.
Why is this like the vertex with the cross? Why is that? Why do we get a new vertex from like the L C counter term?
So one way we could so these counter terms are of the same functional form as the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. We could include them here. Turns out to be less convenient to do so because we've developed the Feynman rules. We'd have to change our definition of the propagator, our derivation of what the propagator is depended on these coefficients. So in principle, you could do that. It turns out to be harder because we'd have to redo that calculation every time. And this just lets us separate out what's new because of the interaction. We can compare.
We still have to redefine things, but we don't. But we can keep what we know, and then we redefine it.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So that's what the first of our assumptions in the LSC reduction formula tells us about how to do perturbation theory. And so our second assumption was that the form factor is the same in the interacting theory as in the free theory. And while this is a strange equation to work with in terms of Feynman diagrams, it's half in momentum space and half in position space. So it's useful to look at some related quantities instead of trying to develop some hybrid Feynman rules that are half in position space and half in momentum space. So on the left-hand side of this equation, we want to think of 5x acting on the vacuum as a one-particle state, at least in the asymptotic past and future. And this is, by definition, also just a one-particle state. So the object that appears on the left-hand side is related to the propagator. So the propagator is the amplitude for a particle to go from one space-time point to another. So in order to see what constrains this condition, puts on our perturbation theory, it'll be easier to work either with the position space or with the momentum space propagator. So this hybrid version. And so let's start. Let's study the position space propagator. Okay, so this is we know how to compute this in the free theory, and it turns out we can actually say a lot about this. The exact propagator in the interacting theory. And the way to do that is we know that we can write the identity as an expansion, as a sum of terms, a number of terms. So the identity operator, so if we have a state, our state space is spanned by the zero particle states, the one particle states, and the multiparticle states. So the identity operator on the zero particle subspace is just this operator here, this reduction operator. The one particle states, you can write them as an integral over kk. So this is a zero particle state. Zero particle part, this is the one particle part. And we can also we also need to include sum or integral over the multiparticle states. And here, so K is the, these are the multiparticle states. And K here is the total momentum. And sigma is all other parameters we need to specify. State. So that includes things like relative momenta between the various particles, as well as particle number, and then any charges. We're dealing with a theory where the particles have other quantum numbers associated with them. So this is the identity operator. You just write the identity as sum of projection operators onto the 0, 1, and multi-particle states, the theory. And after we do that, the term, this term, will just give us 0 once we insert this term here, because we have here omega phi of x omega, which is 0, times omega phi of y omega, which is 0. So this term gives 0. Because the vacuum expectation value of a field operator is 0. And well, these two terms will give us something non-zero. So if we rewrite the Lorentz invariant measure, as I alluded to before, as in terms of the four dimensional measure, then and we define a quantity called the spectral density, which is defined to be 2 pi delta S minus mass squared sum integral over sigma 2 pi so if we rewrite this, rewrite these measures like this, we will have a delta function that's a delta of k squared minus m squared in each of these terms. And so I've written those out over here. And this spectral density basically contains information about what the invariant masses, allowed invariant masses of the n particle states are. So if we plot rho of s versus s, there will be peak, delta peak at m physical squared, and m sigma here is the invariant mass of a multi-particle state. And if we assume that there are no bound states, then m sigma has to be greater than or equal to 2 times the mass of the particle. So the Sigma is the mass of the n particle state, and so if we have a multi-particle state, we've got at least two particles. And if there's no bound state, then the interaction energy between the two particles has to be positive. And the lowest energy multi-particle state is if we have two lowest possible energy for a two-particle state with no binding energy is if we have two particles that are at rest relative to each other, then the total energy of the state is just the mass energy of those two particles. So the there's a no possible invariant mass of an n particle state with a mass less than 2m physical if there's no bound states. So this function is 0 up to 2m physical squared. We have two particles with no relative velocity and no binding energy, no interaction energy. Okay. So if we plug through this exchange of the three-dimensional measure with a four-dimensional measure, and plug it in here, what we'll get in this first term is this delta, as well as a k phi omega. But we also are assuming that k phi omega is e to the I k dot x. And we've got here a k phi omega and a omega phi k. Those two terms will end up canceling out, which is why there's no k phi omega term here. In this other term, well, the same thing, except we can't say anything about what this term is. And so what we've done is essentially we've written the exact propagator for the interacting theory. In terms of one term, it looks very much like the one of the terms we found when we computed the propagator for the free theory, the Klein-Gordon propagator. So we can, from here, repeat all of the same steps we did to derive the Klein-Gordon propagator. And we'd get exactly the same thing for this term, with the one difference that this mass here is the mass of the physical particle, which is not necessarily the same thing as the mass that shows up in the Lagrangian. And we also get an extra term. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Go over that term again. So, the idea that you express this in terms of a single particle state and a multi particle state,
mm-hmm.
I didn't quite get what happened to this. Like, what's the significance of the other term? What do you?
This term is telling us. So, what this spectral density is telling us something about the allowed states in our theory. So it's zero if for a if a particular center mass energy is not allowed in our theory. That's why it's zero for all center mass energies less than 2m physical, except for at m physical, and it's weighted by weighted by the, this should be omega, weighted by the amplitude for a one, for the field operator to create that, that multiparticle state. So it's some, tells us something about what states the field operator acting in the vacuum can evolve to.
The sum and the integral together in the notation is just like a normal sum over sigma and then the integral?
So sigma here is all the other parameters we need to describe the one multiparticle states. So that includes discrete parameters like particle number, as well as continuous parameters like relative momenta. So this is a set, you could really think of this as a set of parameters or summing over some of the elements of the set and integrating over others. And so after some similar calculation, I'm not going to go through all the details, but after some similar calculations to what we did when we calculated the Feynman propagator, we find that the exact propagator, or rather the Fourier transform of the exact propagator, can be written exactly as I over k squared minus m physical squared plus I epsilon plus another term. So this term comes from the one particle part of this identity operator, as well as another term that accounts for the multiparticle states. So this is like the Fourier transform of the exact propagator. And this is an exact result. So we didn't use perturbation theory at all to derive this. Well, I didn't do the full derivation, but a sketch the derivation. So this is saying that, well, if this term were here, this would be a very familiar result. This is basically the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator, with one difference, and that difference is that the mass that shows up here is the physical mass of the particle. This is the mass of the particle you'd measure in the laboratory. I didn't need to make any reference to the Lagrangian of the theory, so it's not, this is not necessarily equal to the mass parameter that shows up in the Lagrangian. So this result here is known as the Chalin-Lemon spectral representation. The Chalin-Lemon and this is an important exact result for the propagator. And in deriving this, we used, in particular, this assumption. That's why we don't have a similar factor here in this term. So we use both of our assumptions. So this formula basically requires the same assumptions as the LSD reduction formula. So if this this equation for the Fourier transform of the exact propagator works, then so does so do our assumptions for the LSE reduction formula. Okay. Yes.
So, is the reason why we're calculating this because we want to like, right? Like, why is this important?
So this is an exact result. So exact results are rare and important, usually important in unfield theory. And this one is important because it gives us a relationship between something we can measure, the physical mass, and something we can compute. So after the break, we're going to compute this in another way. And that we'll see that this will give us a relationship between the physical observable, which is the mass, and some of the parameters that show up in our Lagrangian, which will be both the m that shows up in the Lagrangian as well as some of the z's. So it relates what we use to calculate or describe our theory to what we can measure. Yes.
I'm just wondering, so where exactly did this physical mass come from? Like we introduced it for the spectral density?
Yes.
Why do you have physical mass?
So these states are momentum eigenstates.
Mm-hmm.
These states are defined to be a physical state with three momentum k and energy ek related by the relationship that ek squared is k squared plus the physical mass squared. This is the mass you would measure in a laboratory. So that's like that's the definition of that's what we're assuming these states are.
Okay, so that's where
these are physical states, and that's where it comes in. And so that's why in this delta function, this should be the physical mass. Here's that physical mass. All right, let's pause here for 5 minutes. We'll resume at noon.